Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Oh, wow. What do you think of these warm days? How about the full moon this week? Well, Ken Lane down in Joshua Tree has been noticing all this too, though he's not really crazy about the heat of summer in the desert, but he abides. This week, our episode is titled A Midsummer Night's Desert. It was released June 21st, 2024, and I love this one because he covers a lot of midsummer territory, fairy lore, and ends with a recipe. So get ready to save it. Stay tuned after the coyote's final call for some local lore and nature. And now, off we go.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
If you're listening to this, congratulations. Night has fallen on the desert, and you have made it through the summer solstice. Which is not celebrated too much in the desert. I wonder why. The good news is that we are halfway to winter solstice and only 3 months and change till Halloween. But summertime can be beautiful, especially the summer nights and the high desert when you can still sit outside at night, when you can open the windows all night. Just make sure you close them very early in the morning, unless you live in one of those old adobes like in New Mexico. Then you can sleep in for a little bit. Last night it got down to about 65 where I'm at, and it just feels fantastic when there's a breeze bringing it inside. Turn off all those machines. The fan, the swamp cooler, the infernal air conditioner that makes the roof rumble. And also makes you broke at the end of the month, or beginning of the month, all summer long. But the full moon sure looks pretty when it's hanging low on a summer night, and it's always good to see the bats dive bombing the bugs at dusk. And to see the weird nightjar birds with their enormous frog mouths hopping around the sandy wash like toads. But the best thing to do on a hot summer day in the Mojave, experts say, is to sleep through the hottest parts. From about noon till sundown, generally speaking, so you can enjoy the evenings, which will now start to get a little bit longer. Now, I realize there are people out there who actively enjoy summer in the Mojave, and there's nothing wrong with it. I know a lot of such people. And they do like to make it known. They love the triple digits, and that's fine, especially if you also know your human limitations. I keep reading about people being found dead on Greek islands, tourists who went for a hike, a walk. It's real hot in Greece lately in the Mediterranean. Hotter every summer, they say, and people do feel the need to maximize their limited vacation time, limited by both time and budget. But 100 degrees plus in any language is about 38 degrees Celsius. Well, that's too hot for a tourist to take a long midday walk. Yes, there are people who do it. There are people who've been doing it their whole lives, and they occasionally keel over dead too. But it's the visitor who most often succumbs. So if you're having a holiday in a hot place this weekend, whether you drove out to the desert from the coast or flew in a big jet airplane pouring more carbon into the overburdened atmosphere to a holiday island, spend the hottest part of the day taking it easy. Use the swimming pool if there's one nearby and let the wonders of evaporation keep you cool. Nothing better than getting the shivers while you're sitting in the shade after coming out of the water. It's midsummer. Midsummer sounds so romantic, doesn't it? But I've lived a lot of places, and midsummer has rarely been the most pleasant part of the year, but these places have names such as New Orleans and South Phoenix and Joshua Tree. Little chance of encountering Puck in a shady grove on the river's edge in my part of the Mojave. And there's no running water at all beyond a few canyon seeps that quickly fade into the sandy soil. I have had many strange encounters on desert nights, but they are of different shape and character out here. Befitting a harsh land of angular mountains and shimmering sandy playas. Our fairy circles are the flattened brush around a mutilated range cow. And our fairy lights are harsh like Klieg arcs, jerkily searching the desert ground, born of a dark geometric shape above, impossible to pick out against the night sky. Searching for what? I don't think for anything in particular, but they've seen our machines do it, and these spirits always take a form familiar to the locals, familiar and regionally important. Wild Irish warlords mounted on fine horses galloping across a Galway seashore at dusk, vanishing into the sea mist. Or more in line with the sinister black triangles of the American Southwest, there is the Pooka, from which Shakespeare named his Puck.
Desert Oracle Radio.
But Puck is somewhat unlike the Pooka of the old Britons, the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish, the people of the Isle of Man and the Channel Islands. Puck is a Robin Goodfellow type, generally portrayed as an impish fellow with a generally cheerful face and sparkling eyes. It is impossible to overstate the importance of Robin Goodfellow, the attentive supernatural creature of every rural home. He was the protagonist of May Day and Midsummer celebrations for many centuries before he was slowly replaced by the semi-historical Robin Hood the Outlaw. Robin Goodfellow is the common English version of the Cornish Pixies, the Corrigans of Brittany, the house elf, if you will. Ben Jonson wrote these lines about Robin Goodfellow, published in the year 1625. Sometimes I meet them like a man, sometimes an ox, sometimes a hound, and to a horse I turn me can. Well, such is fairyland, where every rule is regularly ignored, overturned, inverted. The puka is like our flying saucer spirits, a shapeshifter. Or, more accurately, it is without permanent shape, but takes form as one of several menacing, shadowy figures. The immense black horse. The oversized catshe. Also black in color, but for a slash of white upon its chest. A black goat, or a goblin, or even a herd of tiny black pigs. As described in the Manx chapter of the fairy faith in Celtic countries, with this anecdote coming from the Reverend Canon Cooley. Among the old people of this parish, there is still a belief in fairies. About 18 years ago, I buried a man, a staunch Methodist, who said he once saw the road full of fairies in the form of little black pigs, and that when he addressed them in the name of God, "What are ye?" they immediately vanished. He was certain that they were the fairies. And of these black, shadowy figures, there is something as true with the puka as it is true with the big, hairy monsters of North America. The glowing eyes. But you know Puck from A Midsummer Night's Dream, alias Robin Goodfellow. Although he retains his puckish, impish form throughout the play, he too can shapeshift, boasting that he easily becomes a fat and bean-fed horse or a roasted crab in a gossip's bowl. Meaning a baked crab apple, delicious when added to ale or spiced wine, which you drank from a bowl. He could become a vanishing footstool that sends a gloomy woman tumbling to the floor. That makes him laugh. Says Puck, "Fairy, thou speakest aright. I am the merry wanderer of the night." One of Puck's most charming midsummer appearances in works of literature that are not Shakespeare is in Kipling's Puck of Pook's Hill. The children were at the theater, acting to three cows as much as they could remember of Midsummer Night's Dream. Their father had made them a small play out of the big Shakespeare one, and they had rehearsed it with him and with their mother till they could say it by heart. They began where Nick Bottom the Weaver comes out of the bushes with a donkey's head on his shoulder and finds Titania, Queen of the Fairies, asleep. Then they skip to the part where Bottom asks three little fairies to scratch his head and bring him honey. And they ended where he falls asleep in Titania's arms. Dan was Puck and Nick Bottom, as well as all three fairies. He wore a pointy-eared cloth cap for Puck and a paper donkey's head out of a Christmas cracker, but it tore if you were not careful for Bottom. Una was Titania with a wreath of columbines and a foxglove wand. The theater lay in a meadow called the Long Slip, a little mill stream carrying water to a mill two or three fields away bent round one corner of it, and in the middle of the bend lay a large old fairy ring of darkened grass, which was the stage. The mill stream banks, overgrown with willow, hazel, and guelder rose, made convenient places to wait until your turn came. And a grown-up who had seen it said that Shakespeare himself could not have imagined a more suitable setting for his play. They were not, of course, allowed to act on Midsummer Night itself, but they went down after tea on Midsummer Eve, when the shadows were growing, and they took their supper with them, hard-boiled eggs, Bath Oliver biscuits, and salt in an envelope. The three cows had been milked and were grazing steadily with a tearing noise that one could hear all down the meadow. And the noise of the mill at work sounded like bare feet running on hard ground. A cuckoo sat on a gatepost singing his broken June tune, Cuckoo Cuck, while a busy kingfisher crossed from the millstream to the brook, which ran on the other side of the meadow. Everything else was a sort of thick, sleepy stillness, smelling of meadow sweet and dry grass. Their play went beautifully. Dan remembered all his parts, Puck, Bottom, and the three fairies. And Una never forgot a word of Titania. Not even the difficult piece where she tells the fairies how to feed Bottom with apricots, ripe figs, and dewberries. And all the lines end in ease. They were both so pleased that they acted it three times over from beginning to end, before they sat down in the unthistly center of the ring to eat eggs and Bath Olivers. This was when they heard a whistle among the alders on the bank, and they jumped. The bushes parted, in the very spot where Dan had stood as Puck, they saw a small, brown, broad-shouldered, pointy-eared person with a snub nose, slanting blue eyes, and a grin that ran right across his freckled face. He shaded his forehead as though he were watching Quint, Snout, Bottom, and the others rehearsing Pyramus and Thisbe, and in a voice as deep as three cows asking to be milked, he began, "What hempen homespuns have we swaggering here so near the cradle of our fairy queen?" He stopped, hollowed one hand round his ear, and with a wicked twinkle in his eye went on, "What? A play toward? I'll be auditor, an actor too, perhaps, if I see cause." The children looked and gasped. The small thing, he was no taller than Dan's shoulder, stepped quietly into the ring. I'm rather out of practice, said he. But that's the way my part ought to be played. Still, the children stared at him, from his dark blue cap like a big columbine flower to his bare, hairy feet. At last, he laughed. Please don't look like that. It isn't my fault. What else could you expect? He said. We didn't expect anyone, Dan answered slowly. This is our field. Is it? Said their visitor, sitting down. Then what on human earth made you act Midsummer Night's Dream three times over on Midsummer's Eve in the middle of a ring and under, right under one of my oldest hills in old England? Pook's Hill? Puck's Hill? Puck's Hill? Pook's Hill? It's as plain as the nose on my face. He pointed to the bare, fern-covered slope of Pook's Hill that runs up from the far side of the mill stream to a dark wood. Beyond that wood, the ground rises and rises for 500 feet, till at last you climb out on the bare top of Beacon Hill. By oak, ash, and thorn, he cried, still laughing. If this had happened a few hundred years ago, you'd have had all the people of the hills out like bees in June. We didn't know it was wrong, said Dan. Wrong? The little fellow shook with laughter. Indeed, it isn't wrong. You've done something that kings and knights and scholars in old days would have given their crowns and spurs and books to find out. If Merlin himself had helped you, you could not have managed better. You've broken the hills. You've broken the hills. It hasn't happened in 1,000 years. We didn't mean to, said Una. Of course you didn't. That's just why you did it. Unluckily, the hills are empty now, and all the people of the hills are gone. I'm the only one left. I'm Puck, the oldest thing in England. Very much at your service, if you care to have anything to do with me. If you don't, of course, you've only to say so, and I'll go. He looked at the children, and the children looked at him for quite half a minute. His eyes did not twinkle anymore. They were very kind, and there was the beginning of a good smile on his lips. Una put out her hand. Don't go, she said. We like you. I have a Bath Oliver biscuit, said Dan. And he passed over the squashy envelope with the eggs. By oak, ash, and thorn, cried Puck, taking off his blue cap. I like you too. I love that book. And Gelderose is a lovely name for a bush, don't you think? Guess what? It's pretty much the American cranberry, the American high bush cranberry, genetically so close that the two can easily crossbreed. And the berries of both have the same near magical effects on health, too. Like the musical soundscapes you hear on this program, by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Good for what ails ya. Since time out of mind, Gelderose has been taken by mothers-to-be. The bark is often brewed into a tea, as its anti-spasm properties help prevent premature labor and even miscarriage. It was commonly taken by women to lessen monthly cramps, too. Still is by those who know. And that's how its nickname, Cramp Bark, came to be. Some recent studies have even shown that cramp bark is a good treatment for endometriosis. And the whole plant is full of antioxidants. People have taken it to lower their blood pressure and to get to sleep at night. Another miracle plant. Again, the American cranberry bush has basically the same properties, which is why real cranberry juice is the go-to cure for a UTI, a urinary tract infection. I've seen another study that reported garden variety Gelderose slowed or reduced tumors. In rats, at least. But we are so much like the rat. We don't see cranberries in the produce section until autumn because Americans tend to ignore the cranberry until Christmas or Thanksgiving or a UTI. But I love them, so when those bags of organic cranberries show up, I fill up the basket, freeze the ones I'm not using for my world-famous real cranberry business I cook up for the harvest and wintertime dinners. The recipe really is world famous, as I've received mail from around the world about it, praising the ease and tastiness, mostly from the U.S. and Canada, but all saying how everybody likes the real cranberry business. About 15 years ago, when I was working for this politics blog, I posted my Thanksgiving recipe. And a lot of people had no idea cranberry sauce could exist outside of a can. It's so easy to make, I might be able to tell you in the few moments we have left. All right, settle down, coyotes. Real cranberry sauce, cold from the fridge, is one of the best things you can put on a cold lunch plate or add to a sandwich in the hot, hot months of summertime. Slice up some equally cold roasted turkey, stack up some leaf lettuce, etc., then slather a bunch of cranberry business on top, all between a couple of big slices of lightly toasted sheep herder's bread from Bishop. And that's how you beat the summertime sadness. Two bags of fresh cranberries, wash them, dump them in a Pyrex baking dish, and with a regular old cheese grater, grate off about 3 tablespoons worth of orange peel from the big orange you brought home with the cranberries. This is a frontier version of what the chefs call zest. You want to see the slivers of orange peel. It adds color, orange color. That means it's a good food. Now squeeze the juice from the very same orange, the pulp, everything, all over your cranberries. Go easy on the sugar. It doesn't need 2 or 3 cups of sugar. I usually use 1 cup organic brown cane sugar. And then about 3 generous shots of Kentucky bourbon or Tennessee whiskey, that's fine. Some fresh nutmeg and a little cinnamon. Cover your casserole dish, put it in the oven, 300, maybe a half hour. You can make it in a saucepan. When it's hot, you don't want to heat the whole house up with the oven. Make sure it's your correct level of tartness. Put it in the fridge. Goes good with everything. You can make a peanut butter and cranberry sauce sandwich. Put it in a canning jar and it'll keep in the fridge for a good long time. Thanks for all your orders on DesertOracle.com. I think I got everything mailed out, save for whatever came in today. And thanks for supporting the show, the broadcast, at patreon.com/DesertOracle. From Amboy to Zizek and across the Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio, Summer Solstice Full Moon Edition 2024. Boy, that moon is big outside. Good night from the voice of the desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Well, the only puka I ever heard about before now was the one in Harvey. Well, no pukas around my house that I know about, but the birds in our yard have been enjoying the warm days. I have a couple neighbors I buy eggs from, and they say their laying hens are gobbling up dandelion blooms, making the egg yolks extra yellow. Heck, I go out and eat the dandelion blooms myself. At our feeders, we have pine siskins and Cassin's finches, and western tanagers are feeding on the suet cakes as well as the grape jelly I put out for them. A surprise this year is that the black-headed grosbeaks are also feasting on the jelly. Those grosbeaks share the black oil sunflower feeder with white-winged crossbills. Have you ever seen a crossbill? They look like little parrots, and their bills look like tweezers. Here's a bird note about that bird.
This is Bird Note. That's the sound of a red crossbill. Crossbills travel in a small flock in search of seeds from the cones of pines, spruces, and firs. How they obtain those seeds involves a curious adaptation of their bills. First, cross your fingers, like one does for good luck. Now, just like your fingertips, the long tips of the crossbill's upper and lower bill don't meet, but instead cross over each other. To feed, the bird first detaches a cone from a conifer and holds that cone parallel to the branch with its feet. The bird then bites between the scales of the cone and pries them apart by opening its carefully crafted bill. Holding the scales apart, the bird then dislodges the seed with its tongue. Red crossbills search for cones on the tops of the trees, climbing around using their feet and bills, much like parrots. And strangely, they'll breed in winter, if the cone crop is good enough. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know Bird Note delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox? Sign up for our newsletter at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
And then there's those beautiful little yellow flowers all over my yard that I talked about. Well, here's a field note about dandelions, and it's titled Dandelions, Weed or Wonder by Cassie 70, originally broadcast in April of 2021.
It's time for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center. I looked out my window one spring morning to see the solid green yard below, devoid of any flowers. The landscapers came by recently, so maybe mowing chopped the flower heads off? But around 11 a.m. I glanced again to a lawn suddenly littered with yellow blooms, tiny scattered suns getting a late start to the day. The common dandelions, or Taraxacum officinale, persisted. Perhaps the landscapers didn't bother trying to remove the dandelions because they knew the effort would be futile. When I was a child, my dad taught me how to use a spade to dig deep to remove them from the root. Any bit of root left behind in the dirt could regrow. Winter also fails to kill off the perennial plant. Why did we have to dig them up? I wondered. They're a weed, my dad said. But they're so pretty, I thought, collecting bundles to present to my mom at the end of long summer days. What makes them a weed? People don't like them, my dad explained. They spread fast, grow where we don't want them to grow, that is, all over our lawns, and they're hard to get rid of. Hence the dirty spade in my hand. And yet I could not resist searching for the roundest, fullest seed heads, making a wish, and blowing the seeds into the wind. Every child knows if you get them all off in one go, your wish comes true. I preferred to consider each seed as its own wish, with the potential to come true if it successfully planted. Much to my dad's and neighbors' dismay if they knew. And dandelions do so love our lawns. where they can take root in the disturbed soil and easily reach sunlight among the short grass. Humans' age-old habits of building houses and infrastructure and digging up food have created ideal habitat for dandelions for thousands of years. But they haven't always been hated and dubbed weeds. The plant originated in Europe and Asia, where people valued dandelions for medicine, food, and wine. The officinale part of the scientific name even comes from long-ago pharmacies keeping dandelions in stock. And the entire plant is edible. But don't try to eat any of the ones at your local park, as I did as a kid. They are very good at absorbing pesticides without dying. Dandelions migrated to much of the world by accident, as seeds blew on the wind or stuck to travelers. However, migrants from Europe brought them to America on purpose to continue the traditional uses of dandelions as food, drink, and medicinal herb. The flower may have pleasantly reminded immigrants of their former homes, too, in a new landscape. Not needing pollination to go to seed, dandelions spread across the continent faster than the European colonists. Settlers in the American West even relied on ground-up dandelion root as a coffee substitute in hard times. Dandelions shifted from a plant so valued that people crossed oceans with a stash to the most hated weed when lawns became a popular and necessary home feature. Suddenly, the ubiquity we formerly cherished became the dandelion's worst trait. This always struck me as fickle and arbitrary on our part, but dandelions do not care what we think of them. They just grow. Gazing out my window as the flowers opened for a spring morning, I saw the resilience and resourcefulness of a plant that unashamedly grows in yards and sidewalk cracks. I collected a small bundle of dandelions to place in a tiny vase in my kitchen. In doing so, I recognized the resilience and resourcefulness of humans, and my inner child delighted at the yellow puffs. This field note was written in the Field Notes Writing Workshop at the Montana Natural History Center. I'm Cassie Seveny for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center, providing natural history education for schools and the public throughout Montana. For information on upcoming events and programs at the center, please call 327-0405 or visit our website at montananaturalist.org.
Now I'm going to invite you to come walk with me along the river at Missouri Headwaters State Park. Well, today it's about 6 o'clock in the evening, on Friday evening, and I am walking on one of my favorite places. If you listen to the program, you're going to figure this out real fast, but I'll just tell you, I'm out at the headwaters of the Missouri, and I'm walking along the path that has been set up by the Sacagawea Audubon and the Trident factory, or whatever they call it, that set this up in the first place. I know that Audubon comes out here and has volunteers that help keep the burdock under control, because when the burdock puts on its thorny little seed heads, they will snare and trap small birds that are looking for the seeds, and then those birds just die kind of impaled on them. So they come out here and pull those burdocks out. The burdock is not something you really want to let flourish out here. But when I got here, I thought I heard the canyon wrens. I'm hoping we can hear some of that. I can kind of hear, I think what I'm hearing is the cement factory down there. It's not unusual for a train to come by. Oh, and the weather here today is very warm. I think around 82 degrees right now. The sun is shining. There are some beautiful thunderheads in the distance. Yeah. Yeah. I like thunderheads. I love thunderstorms. When I grew up out in Nebraska, you could always see the big storms coming because everything's so flat out there. You'd see them coming across the western horizon, headed right for you, because everything seemed to go from west to east. You know, as if a wind was blowing everything across from the mountains. So, even with that hum in the background, it's okay. This is a very nourishing, good place. Where else can you find a path and hope you see a peregrine falcon? I think a fly is following me, probably one of those territorial flies. I don't know if they're horse flies or not. Have you ever had them kind of follow you for a while along a trail and then suddenly they stop? It seems like I read somewhere that that's a territorial thing. There's lots of little yellow flowers kind of in clusters on top of green plants that have kind of spiny looking leaves, and those plants are anywhere between 2 and 3 feet tall. Things just they spring up here fast once summer hits. Oh yeah. And I see some invasives. You're always going to see those along where people are. I think it's cheatgrass that I'm seeing, which is already brown, trying to release its seeds soon, I suppose. And then there's taller grasses that already the seed heads are brown. Have you ever looked at the seed head of these tall grasses? These grasses are maybe the stalks are about 3 feet tall again, but have you ever looked really close at one of those little packets of seeds? They're really pretty. Even when they're green, they're pretty. It's like they have little teeny tiny flowers on the end of each little bracket. I don't know my grasses. I've heard it's a real challenge to identify them all. I know things like foxtails, but there's probably a lot of varieties of those. Where do you like to walk? Well, this week I'm going to read you one of the stories out of Tales from America's National Parks, Campfire Stories, Volume 1, edited by Dave Q. and Alyssa Q. It's K-Y-U are the authors. Forgive me, you guys, if I am not saying that last name right. But these are a really cool little series of books. Anyway, onward. First, I'm going to read to you a little bit about this story. Although there are 26 native tribes associated with Yellowstone today, their stories are absent from the records of European explorers. William Clark of the Lewis and Clark expedition surmised that natives were afraid of the geysers, an assumption now widely believed to be absurdly false. More likely is that the natives were intentionally not telling the Europeans about their sacred lands. The origins of the Yellowstone River is one of the only verified and authentic native stories of the region. This version was told by a Northern Shoshone man named Ralph Dixie and collected in 1953 by folklorist Ella E. Clark. Other than this story, there is little reliable information or documentation of legends, myths, and other Native folklore about Yellowstone. Without Dixie and Clark, we would not know the role that mischievous coyote played in creating the waterfalls and lakes of Yellowstone. So our reading today is The Origin of the Snake and Yellowstone Rivers by Ralph Dixie. Long ago, there was no river in this part of the country. No Snake River ran through the land. During that time, a man came up from the south. No one knows what kind of person he was, except that among his people, he was always nosing around, always sticking his nose into everything. He came through this valley, traveled north past Teton, and then went up on a mountain in what is now called the Yellowstone Country. He looked around there and soon found an old lady's camp. She had a big basket of fish in water, all kinds of fish. And the man was hungry, so he said to her, "I am hungry. Will you boil some fish for me?" "Yes, I will cook some for you," the old lady answered. "But don't bother any fish," she warned, as she saw him looking into the basket. But he did not obey her. While she was busy cooking, he kept nosing around, kept monkeying around. At last, he stepped on the edge of the basket and spilled the fish. The water spread all over. The man ran fast ahead of the water and tried to stop it. He piled some rocks up high in order to hold the waters back, but the water broke his dam and rushed over the rocks. That's where Upper Yellowstone Falls are now. The man ran ahead of the water again, and again he tried to stop it. 4 or 5 miles below Yellowstone Falls, he built another pile of rocks, but that didn't hold the water back either. The rush of water broke that dam too. That's where the Lower Yellowstone Falls are today. The water kept on rushing and formed the Yellowstone River. Then the man ran to the opposite side of the fish basket, to the other side of the water emptying from it. He built another dam down the valley where Idaho Falls are now. By the time he got there, the flood had become bigger and swifter. And so the man built a big dam. The water broke it and rushed on down the valley. Again he ran, overtook the water, and built another dam. "That's where I'm going to stop it," he said to himself. But the water had become bigger and bigger, swifter and swifter. So it broke the dam and left the American Falls where they are today. The man rushed ahead and built 2 piles of rocks in the form of a half circle, one pole where Shoshone Falls are now, and one where Twin Falls are now. "I'll really stop the water this time," he said to himself. But the water filled the dam, broke it, and rushed over the rocks in giant waterfalls. The man ran ahead, down to where Huntington, Oregon is today. There the valley narrows into a canyon. "Here's where I'll stop the water," he said, "here between these high hills." So he built a dam and walked along the top of it, singing and whistling. He was sure he had stopped the water this time. He watched it coming towards him, sure that he would soon see it stop. It filled the dam, broke it, and rushed on down the canyon. Hell's Canyon, it's called today. Just before the dam broke, the man climbed up on top of the canyon wall. "I give up," he said. as he watched the water rush through the gorge. "I won't build any more dams. They don't stop that water." After the river left Hell's Canyon, it became wide again and very swift. The water went on down to Big River and then on down to the oceans, taking with it the big fish that had spilled out of the old lady's basket. That's why we have only small fish up here. Salmon and sturgeon were carried on down to the ocean, and they have never been able to get back up here because of the waterfalls. Salmon used to come up as far as Twin Falls a long time ago, but they don't come up now. The big fish basket that the man tipped over is Yellowstone Lake. The water that he spilled ran off in two directions. Some of it made the Snake River, as I have told you, and finally reached the Columbia and the Pacific. Some of it ran the other way and made the Yellowstone River, and then reached the Missouri River. Who was the old lady with the basket of water and fish? She was Mother Earth. Who was the man who wanted to see everything, who was always sticking his nose into everything? He was Izepa, or Coyote. Okay, this is the part where I get to tell you about some events coming up that might interest you. First off, Grow Wild Montana is sponsoring a lot of events coming up. And one of them is the Wildflower and Weed Hike, and that's on July 8th from 9 to 11 in the morning. Rendezvous at the Ouzel Falls Trailhead. Hikes will last 2 hours and proceed at plant identification pace, and it's free and open to everyone. And there are too many events for me to list all of them here, but you can go online to growwildmontana.org, and that's growwildmt.org, and click on the events tab, and you will see all kinds of things to do in the summer. So enjoy that one. Oh yeah, you can also email them at info@growwildmontana.org. So that's info@growwildmt.org for information. The Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness is going to have an educational hike. The title is Floods, Fire, and Fish, featuring Ashley Brubaker, Trout Unlimited, and that's on July 13th, 2024, at the Passage Creek Falls at 9 in the morning. This is free and educational. It says, this scenic walk to an iconic waterfall will be stream and fish focused. We will discuss native Yellowstone cutthroat trout and the impacts from non-native brook trout, stream morphology, and the role of fire and wood in the stream. And we can talk about impacts from the 2022 flood. And that sounds like a fun one to learn more about that and other volunteer projects. You can go to their website, which is abwilderness.org. So abwilderness.org. And go to the Get Involved tab. And then look at Educational Hikes to find more out about this hike. And if you want to volunteer with some of their projects, there's also a place where you can volunteer. It's called 2024 Volunteer Projects. It lists all the projects, and that is also under the Get Involved tab. And the Mountain Girl is sponsoring some really cool summer events that you might want to get involved in. And I'm just going to tell you, their website is themountaingirl.com, and it's spelled themtgirl.com, and click on the events tab. They have several of their events. Let's see, one of them is Ladies Who Cast Level 1. They also have First Aid for Outdoor Adventures. Art in Nature is another one. And then Ladies Who Cast Level 2. And these are all going on in late June and July, the whole month of July. So, check that one out. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for their continuing work on Desert Oracle Radio. Our sounds today came from the Missouri River and my yard, from birdnote.org, and from Montana Natural History Center's Field Notes. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening today. You can leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but I have. The mainstream news and political ads these days can be very distressing. So if you cannot fix what you read or hear about, maybe turn your focus to something you can make better. In honor of those working to make good changes, I am thanking Avi Kaplan for the song Change on the Rise to take us out. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams.
Change on the rise. Mm-hmm. What good's a man who's lost his soul? Can't take a stand. His flame's gone cold. Fend off the enemy. Sing out the jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know. The morning time, yeah. We're going strong, headed up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the rise. Time, yeah, we're going strong.